Welcome to the 11KPW podcast on financial services regulation and employment law by Tom Ogg. This talk was given at the 11KPW Employment Law Conference on the 14th of May 2015. For more podcasts and information, please visit 11kpw.com.
This is my second employment law conference in 2 days, and I'm again speaking about financial regulation. I came down from Leeds last night from the ELA conference, I'm very pleased to be here. I'm going to speak not for the full 45 minutes that I'm scheduled for in your pack, you'll be pleased to hear, maybe 30 minutes and a bit. What I'm going to do is talk you through some of the most common issues that arise in an employment law context that involve financial regulation. For some of you, these will be very familiar and common matters that you deal with. For others of you, they may be somewhat intimidating topics that come up unexpectedly and somewhat unwelcomely. And then finally, I'm going to talk through some proposals on whistleblowing that are currently being that the regulators are currently consulting upon. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about the senior managers regime and certification regimes, which are going to come into force on the 7th of March 2016. Financial regulation is increasingly important for employment lawyers, primarily because the regulators are increasingly interested in what individuals are doing, and the regulators are increasingly keen to hold individuals to account. Often an employment law problem becomes a regulatory problem very quickly today, and the range and scope of the requirements are increasing greatly. So for those of you who are not familiar with the area, just briefly, there are two regulators. There's the FCA, the Financial Conduct Authority. They are primarily concerned with conduct of firms and individuals, and all firms and individuals. They take the lead on disciplining firms and individuals for misconduct. And you've got the PRA, the Prudential Regulation Authority. They have a different focus and a different set of regulatory objectives. Their job is to make sure that banks, insurers, and investment banks are solvent. So although Prudence had a terrible breakup with Gordon Brown in 2008. She's got a new job in the city at the Bank of England, at the PRA, to make sure that the banks stay prudent. The main act is known as FSMA, the Financial Services and Markets Act, and then you may be familiar with the FCA handbook and what is slowly becoming the PRA rulebook, both of which are immense, and the provisions relating to individuals, for the most part, are sort of sprinkled throughout those handbooks. The handbooks are primarily drafted for firms because the traditional focus of the regulator has been upon firms and firm conduct. It's now changing orientation to concentrate specifically on individuals, as I'll go on to discuss. The current regime is known as the approved persons regime. This applies to all firms in the financial sector. And what it bites upon in relation to individuals are what are called controlled functions. So that's a function that's set out in the rules as essentially a regulated role within a firm. And each controlled function has a set of letters and numbers. So you may sometimes hear people talking about CF1s or CF30s. A CF30 is a customer function. They're an individual who deals with customers or a customer's property. They're the vast bulk of individuals that you will probably come across, unless you're dealing with very senior individuals who are known as SIFs, or significant influence functions. They're the set of individuals at the top of the bank or firm who are either directors or they have a special role which the regulators have specified as requiring pre-approval. So, Section 59 of FSMA, this is the starting point. This provides that firms must take reasonable care to ensure that no individual performs a controlled function without approval from the regulator. In other words, the regulator set up a barrier, a perimeter. You should not fulfil this role before you've been approved by the regulators. And if an individual does fulfil one of those controlled functions, then there are sanctions, both on the firm — it's a breach of a relevant requirement and engages the sanctions in Part 14 of FSMA — and on the individual can have a financial penalty imposed on them under Section 63. So it's key to make sure that applications are made. Now, there is provision for temporary or unforeseen absences. An individual can fulfil a role for up to 12 weeks. But otherwise, an application will have to be made. And an application has to be made in respect of each controlled function. So it's not good enough to be approved and then you can do any role in the firm. It's approval for a specific role. So if you're approved to be a customer function, you can't go and be the CEO. You need to make a new application. Okay, so what's involved in applications for approval? How does this work? Well, first of all, it's the firm that applies rather than the individual. The individual will often be involved in various ways, but it's for the firm to apply for the individual to carry on the function. The individual will have to complete a declaration of the accuracy relating to the information that's given to the regulators, for example. And it's crucial that the application is made before the individual starts to fulfil the role, as I've said before. So what does this mean? This means offers of employment should be conditional upon approval from the regulator. And it means that if an individual does get an offer from another firm, it will be wise not to resign from their current role until regulatory approval has been received. Okay. So what are the time limits? What's involved practically in liaising with the regulator? Well, the starting point is, under normal circumstances, the regulator has 3 months to determine whether to approve the individual. But that's 3 months only whilst the application is complete. So there's a stop-the-clock provision. So if the regulator decides that the application is not complete and they need some further information in some respect, they will stop the clock. They'll stop that 3 months running, wait for the response from the firm, usually via the individual, and then the clock will start again. Now, the regulators have a lot of discretion over when an application is not complete, and sometimes you get some pretty perplexing questions through whose real purpose is to just stop the clock to make sure there's no breach of FSMA. And there's also a little bit of a tactical game in the sense of these deadlines, because if you answer the questions quickly, a little bit like cross-examination, then the regulator has to think quite quickly about what they're going to ask next. The team that you don't want to be allocated to is called non-routine individuals. If your applicant's been allocated to that team, then the FCA is thinking about refusing the application, and it will probably need some further scrutiny. Now then, there are a series of forms in relation to individuals. You'll probably have heard of Form C, which is the form that has to be filled in when someone is dismissed or suspended. But there are a series of other forms. Form A is where the application is made to the regulator. There's a long Form A, which contains details of fitness and propriety of the individual. B is withdrawing your application. C, as I'll come on to in a minute, is when the individual leaves their post. D is where they stay in post, but their details have changed. And the most important respect in which they might change is their fitness and propriety. And then E is an internal transfer to some other regulated role. So what is fit? Well, unfortunately, the regulator doesn't have a series of people sitting down Googling applicants for approval to see if they're attractive or not. It's about fitness and propriety in a general sense. And there's a section of the FCA handbook called FIT, which explains what fitness and propriety is. Now, the first point is that it's fitness and propriety to perform the function. So it's not necessarily whether they're fit and proper in and of themselves. It's whether they're fit and proper to perform the role. So they might be fit and proper to perform a customer function, dealing with customers, but they might not be fit to be a director, for example. And the main criteria that the regulators apply are honesty, integrity and reputation, competence and capability, and financial soundness. Okay, so this is the main provision in respect of notifications. This is what probably causes the most trouble in an employment context when problems have arisen in the employment relationship, there's a suspicion of misconduct, and a notification has been made. Employees often want to know why or how the employer has made the notification and whether they've done that lawfully within the rules and whether there's anything they can do about it. Well, unfortunately, for the most part, the answer is not a lot. So long as the employer has made the notification in good faith, there's relatively little that you can do. But there are specific provisions which are important to know and refer to. So the provisions in respect of Form C, which applies as follows. If the individual has been dismissed or suspended, they've resigned during the course of an investigation, or otherwise there's information that might affect the individual's fitness and propriety. That's when the Form C should be submitted, and it should be submitted within 7 business days of one of those key events occurring. However, there's also a notification required as soon as practicable that a so-called qualified Form C will be sent in. In other words, that they are concerned about the individual's fitness and propriety. Now, Form D, as I mentioned earlier, is where the individual doesn't leave employment, but there's information relevant to their fitness and propriety. So if they, for example, go off on maternity or shared parental leave and they're still employed, but the employer has serious concerns about that individual, Form D is the form that you would use to say to the regulator, we're really worried about what's happened in relation to this individual. And then finally, there are general notification requirements. You can see the details set out in my pack, but the most important additional one relates to prosecutions or convictions. So if an individual or firm is being prosecuted for some issue, then a notification is required. And the regulator gets particularly upset in relation to money laundering application allegations or prosecutions. For obvious reasons, an individual in charge of a financial firm who's accused of money laundering. Okay. Now, the next topic is references. So the position at common law that you'll be familiar with is that there's no general duty to provide a reference, but if one is required, then it must be true, accurate, fair, not misleading, but it doesn't need to be comprehensive. Now, in the financial services context, there are additional obligations, and I've set out the relevant one on the slide. If a reference is requested, then there's a regulatory obligation to provide all relevant information of which it is aware. Now, I must say, I get the sense that this particular provision isn't always adhered to as closely as it might be, but it exists. Now, this obligation, along with the obligations relating to Form C and notifications, apply regardless of any agreement between an individual and the firm, and that includes specifically a COTS 3 agreement. Okay, so now, whistleblowing. We're now getting on to some of the newer material and proposals that the regulator has. So first of all, the current position. Well, the twist, the financial regulation twist to whistleblowing in this context is that the FCA and the PRA are prescribed persons for the purpose of whistleblowing regulations. Now, what that means is that the conditions for a disclosure to be protected are different as compared to a disclosure to some other third party. So if an individual makes a disclosure to another third party, some of the conditions can be very onerous. It must not be made for personal gain. It must be reasonable in all the circumstances and so on. Those onerous conditions don't apply if a protected disclosure is made to the regulators. The only additional requirement is that the worker reasonably believes that the information and allegations are substantially true. Otherwise, the schema is much the same as a disclosure to an individual's employer. Now, that may seem like a relatively minor point, but as you will know, some disclosures are of the nature, well, I'm not entirely sure about all of this, but there's definitely something that's not right here. Now, that's the kind of disclosure that could fall foul of this provision of it must be substantially true, both the information and the allegations contained therein, if the disclosure to the regulators is to be protected. And what does it mean that the relevant failure falls within the FCA PRA area? Well, what it means is in the prescribed persons regulations, there are a series of matters that are listed that essentially reflect what the regulators do. So the vast majority of disclosures will fall within that area, but they have to have a regulatory or financial flavour for the regulators to be interested in, more specifically, for the disclosure to be protected. Now, there's one other provision of which you should be aware. It's section 131A of FSMA. That relates to market abuse. So if an individual makes a disclosure as soon as possible regarding market abuse, then any obligation not to make the disclosure is disapplied. So there's very narrow circumstances in which that will apply. But it's the only other financial regulation-specific provision. So you should look that up if market abuse is the subject of the potential disclosure. Now, what's the position in respect of whistleblowing more generally in terms of policy and what the regulators do? Well, they have a whistleblowing unit. It's got five or so full-time employees who are there receiving disclosures from individuals across the city and more widely. And in respect of firms, the FCA and PRA have relatively weak provisions. Firms are encouraged to have internal procedures relating to whistleblowing. Many of the larger firms have very sophisticated whistleblowing procedures and policies and units and so forth, but there's strictly no requirement for that to occur. The only provision with any bite is this CISC 18.2.3G, and what that says is that if a whistleblower has a detriment placed upon them, then that calls into question the fitness and propriety of the firm and the individual. Now, what does that mean? It means that the firm might have its permission to undertake regulated activities removed, and in particular, the individual who's responsible for that detriment might be so-called banned from the city or prohibited from undertaking a controlled function. So, in other words, the regulator's saying, we're interested in this, and in particular, we take really seriously any allegation that a whistleblower has been mistreated. A couple of other points. The FCA has recently developed some useful web pages that explain how its whistleblowing unit operates and what it will do with an individual's disclosure. And in particular, it emphasises that although they'll try and keep in touch with a whistleblower, they won't necessarily be able to tell them what they've done with the information because there are various prohibitions on the regulator explaining to a whistleblower what they've done or not done. And then finally, earlier last year, the regulators considered whether financial incentives should be provided to whistleblowers. The regulators decided not. They looked at the US system and they decided that providing financial incentives wouldn't improve the quality or the quantity of whistleblowing in the UK. They also noted, by the way, that the financial incentives provision in the US produced substantial fees for lawyers in the US, which I assume was a negative in the consultation. Okay. Now, there's some interesting statistics on the number of whistleblowing disclosures to the FCA last year. As you can see, they've been rising precipitously. Why is this? Well, one reason is that the regulators have been talking about whistleblowing. They've made clear that they're interested in whistleblowing reports from individuals. And maybe individuals working in the financial services sector are more interested in dealing with misconduct. Maybe there's more misconduct that's having the whistle blown about it. It's difficult to say. One of the other reasons why a disclosure is made to the regulator, however, is sometimes in relation to a litigation strategy, especially on exit. And it's worth just sounding a note of caution, because the regulators don't promise immunity or to protect an individual who makes the disclosure to the regulator. They're keen to emphasise that they'll protect confidentiality so far as possible and so on. But if an individual is blowing the whistle about misconduct that they've been involved in, that can be a risky strategy, not just whistleblowing to the regulator, but also, in particular, letting the employer know that they've whistleblown to the regulator, because then the firm might think, right, well, OK, if we're going to play this game, I'll tell the regulator everything you've been up to. And then the individual may find it very difficult to get a job in a controlled function again. So it can be somewhat risky if the individual is implicated in misconduct. And I think that's an important issue to be aware of. Just some stats. The regulator looked at 650 whistleblowing reports in 2013. 159 of them were of little value, according to the regulator, but 124 were at least of significant value. So it sounds like some of them, at least, a good proportion, almost as many as the duds, are providing important and useful information to the regulators. So what are they proposing to do? Well, they want to implement rules. So first of all, this applies only to banks, that is, banks, building societies, credit unions, investment banks, and insurers. But the proposals for this group are rather more on the front foot, so far as the regulator goes. First of all, there'll be a requirement to have a whistleblowing unit and a series of requirements relating to what that whistleblowing unit should be able to do. It should be able to deal with anonymous tip-offs. It should be able to track whether an individual has been subjected to a detriment after a whistleblowing report has been made. It should do various other things, like, first of all, be in compliance rather than HR due to conflicts of interest. They also propose that the firm should have a whistleblower's champion, who should normally be the chairman of the board, and that whistleblower's champion should oversee the whistleblowing unit. The regulators also say, somewhat problematically, that they should be personally contactable by individuals who want to blow the whistle. Now, you will sit there and think, the poor chairman, how quickly are they going to become a witness and ET proceedings in wherever it is? So we'll see whether the regulators stick with that proposal. But they're quite keen on having a very senior member of the board there to make sure that whistleblowing arrangements are robust. And at the moment, they're called the whistleblower's champion. And then the second point relates, in a sense, to PEDA. What the regulators want to do is to require the firm, as a matter of firm policy, to give whistleblower protections to a far wider group of individuals than are currently protected under PEDA. Somewhat surprisingly, they're talking about protecting almost anyone who makes almost any type of disclosure should be, as a matter of the firm's policy, given whistleblower protections, and in particular, they shouldn't have a detriment imposed upon them. The way they put it is that whistleblowers should be given the same level of protection as those under PEDA at the moment. Now, it's very unclear what that actually means in practice, because how do you give an intern or a supplier or a counterparty the same protection as is provided under PEDA? It's really not clear. Some have suggested that this means some kind of contractual requirement or contractual protection that a detriment won't be imposed, but that seems very problematic for a number of reasons. I think more likely it means that as a matter of the firm's policy and the firm's approach to the issue, that they shouldn't do certain things. And the regulator will, as a matter of its normal supervisory role, take a dim view of anything that happens that's not in the spirit. But it is really rather unclear exactly what is meant by this provision at the moment. And it's one to watch for the policy statement, which is due in June. The next point of which you will need to be aware relates to employment contracts and settlement agreements. What the regulator wants to require, or is proposing to require, is that all employment contracts in banks and insurers and all settlement agreements should include this provision here, which states that nothing shall preclude the employee from making a protected disclosure to the regulators regardless. Now, that already reflects the current law. It's Section 43J of the Employment Rights Act 1996. What the regulators want to do is to make very clear to everyone that that is as the law stands. Now, query, however, whether this captures warranties, which sometimes are included in settlement agreements, that the individual knows of no matters that could form the basis of a protected disclosure, which sometimes are used where an individual's made a series of disclosures and the firm wants to put it to a stop and make sure that the individual's not going to go on making protected disclosures. Query whether that's caught by this provision of the ERA or whether the regulators will do anything about it. And then finally, the regulators are proposing to require that if there's a successful employment tribunal claim relating to whistleblowing, so this is presumably an unfair dismissal or a detriment claim, that they should notify the regulators. Now, for the most part, I think the regulators would be somewhat surprised if they only found out about such a claim when the banker insurer lost the case. Normally, they would want to know about such things at a very early stage. But the requirement, as proposed, is there. Now, just for information, the consultation closes on the 22nd of May, should you wish to respond. Okay, so what I'm going to talk about just for the next few minutes is the proposed senior managers and certification regimes, which are going to be brought into effect for the most part on the 7th of March 2016. What this is all about is the perception that too few individuals were individually held to account for the failures of banks during the financial crisis and in relation to LIBOR subsequently. We'll all remember, famously, Fred Goodwin had his knighthood stripped from him and he was denied entry to St Andrew's Golf Club. But the FSA concluded that he broke none of their rules, and this was very embarrassing for the regulator. So what the proposal is, essentially, is to make sure that more senior bankers are held to account when there's a failure within a firm. And that's really what this is all about. Now, the regime applies to banks, building societies, credit unions, and a form of the regime applies to insurers, but only really in respect of the allocation of responsibilities that I'll talk about in a minute. This is really about banks and the relevant provisions in FSMA and the Banking Reform Act, which was passed in 2013. They all apply to banks. So the starting point is the allocation of responsibilities. You may have heard of the Parliamentary Commission on Banking Standards, led by Andrew Tyrie MP. He's a vociferous reformer of banks, and they produced a very comprehensive and long report containing a number of proposals that are now being implemented in relation to the senior managers and certification regimes. Now, what they complained of in that report is that the regulators often come across an accountability firewall whenever they try to find out what went wrong in a particular bank. They complained specifically that senior management responsibility was either not allocated or shared on committees, so that when the regulator tried to find out who was responsible for a particular area, it was very difficult to determine whether any individual did have responsibility. So what the regulators are proposing to do is to require banks to very clearly allocate responsibilities to individual senior managers. First of all, by carving out very specific roles for individuals on the board and the level just below the board. So we're talking sort of 30 or 40 senior managers. And each of them will have a specific role. So the head of audit will have responsibility for internal audit, for example. And then beyond that, there are a set of what are called prescribed responsibilities, which must be allocated to an individual senior manager for the most part. So one, for example, is capital and liquidity. You would not have wanted to have the capital and liquidity prescribed responsibility at RBS in 2008 because you would be the one on the hook for the bank failure. So the idea is to make clear who is responsible for what. Now, those responsibilities have to be reflected in a document for individuals called a Statement of Responsibilities, which makes clear for that individual what they're responsible for and, by implication, what they're not responsible for. And then for the bank as a whole, there has to be what's called a responsibilities map, whereby you should be able to see across the whole of the piece who is responsible for what. Now, why is this particularly relevant? Well, first of all, if you know who's responsible for what, then you know who to have on the hook. And then, hopefully, if the individuals know who's responsible for what, they'll be more likely to make sure that misconduct doesn't occur in the first place. But in particular, there's a new regulatory tool called the presumption of responsibility. This is effectively a reverse burden of proof. So for a senior manager, if there's a failure by the firm in an area for which a particular senior manager is responsible for, they will be guilty of misconduct without more at that point. However, they have a defence. It's called the reasonable steps defence. So if the senior manager can show that they took such steps as a person in the senior manager's position could reasonably be expected to take, then they can prevent the disciplinary action by the regulators. Now, there are lots of difficulties that arise in relation to the reasonable steps defence and lots of conflicts of interest between the firm and the individual. One, for example, relates to a difficult decision that the board has to make. So if you're the senior manager responsible for a particular area and you think your area needs more resources to make sure that a failure doesn't take place, but the board, for whatever reason, thinks that resources should be allocated elsewhere, what are the reasonable steps that you have to take? It's difficult to know. Should you note your dissent, whistleblow to the regulators? Should you resign? It's difficult to know. It all comes back to the reasonable steps point. And then secondly, the crucial consequence of transferring the burden is a practical one and relates to evidence. So at the moment, some bankers are in the habit of not keeping very good records and making sure their names are not on documents, not on certain emails, because it's very difficult to show that a manager hasn't taken reasonable steps if there's an absence of evidence as to what actually happened. But now it's for the senior manager to show that they did take reasonable steps. So if you don't have that documentary evidence to show what you did, why, and how you took reasonable steps, then you're in trouble as a senior manager. So the absence of evidence, instead of a problem for the regulator, becomes a problem for the individual. So banks are going to have to think very carefully about how they record decisions by senior individuals to help those individuals establish the reasonable steps defence in future. And then there's a criminal offence, but I need say little more than it will probably never be used in the absence of extreme fraud. Even Nick Leeson wasn't a senior manager, you'll recall, and the criminal offence only applies to senior managers. Finally, there are new conduct rules, the most important of which relates to treating customers fairly. These rules apply on a far wider basis than currently, so only about 6-10% of a bank is of the individuals in a bank are subject to these rules. Almost everyone will be subject to the rules in future. And they will have an individual responsibility to treat customers fairly and to make sure that a product is suitable for an individual when they sell it to them. I predict, therefore, much more whistleblowing because of that conduct rule and not merely because of the whistleblowing proposals. So just to finish off, a couple of points of interest. So I explained at length the approvals process that I talked about earlier. under the new certification regime, there will be no approvals process. It will be for the bank to assess the fitness and propriety of individuals rather than for the regulator. So that regulatory perimeter will fall away for banks in future. Instead, there's a requirement upon banks to take up regulatory references for the last 5 years of that individual's employment. And as you can imagine, that throws up a set of problems on its own. The notification requirements are far stricter. Instead of suspension, resignation, dismissal, a notification is now required if a written warning is, or will be required if a written warning is issued, or there's recovery of remuneration, or that the firm suspects that a conduct rule has been broken. So as you can see, far broader, more sweeping notification requirements. There are problems in relation to handovers. The firm will be required to produce a pack for the new senior manager, which explains all of the things that the senior manager needs to know. Now, obviously, the departing senior manager is going to want to have a role in that handover process in order to vindicate what they've been doing whilst they're at the firm. That raises all sorts of issues relating to whistleblowing, whether any documents produced in the course of that process will be disclosable in litigation, and so forth. So I predict that recruitment will become far more protracted and difficult at banks in future. And then just finally, what should your clients be doing now? Well, I know that all of the big banks are well onto this for the most part, but it's smaller banks, branches of foreign firms, small subsidiaries, who will have this regime applied to them in a tailored way. They will need to get cracking to be ready for early 2016. And they should be thinking about what policies and procedures do they already have in place. What have they already got available to them? And from there, you can work out what will need to change. So that's it from me. There'll probably be a lot more to say on these topics in the future. Thank you very much.